This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
A very good afternoon to you. Happy Monday. Long weekend. Lucky if you've got it. I'm a little bit jealous. If you haven't already been there, taking you to the Perth Royal Show after 12:30 today. I spent about maybe 5 hours or so there yesterday. I got there nice and early, avoided some of the crowd in the early part of the day anyway, but it certainly started building. There was a massive crowd, sort of around about 1-2 o'clock by the time everyone else got there, but did spend some time, you know, dragging myself and the kids around the rides, Showbag Alley, but even got to spend a little bit of time having looked through the poultry, some of the wood chopping, through the shearing shed too, having a look at all the wool. So we did get that little taste of the agricultural side of the Perth Royal Show. John Daly is there this afternoon, so we'll catch up with him before 1 o'clock today. Also, could Northern Australia become the spice-producing bowl of Australia? That's the question that needs to be answered, and there'll be a few trials put in of, say, cumin, fennel, caraway and black sesame seeds, things like that, going to be trialled just to see if they're viable and to see if that can really get off the ground. And we will kick off today, and we've been talking about this a lot over recent months. This is the pig-killing disease known as African swine fever, and it's now well and truly on Australia's doorstep, with confirmation of an outbreak in Timor-Leste. It's estimated the disease has already wiped out 25% of the world's pig population. It's been spreading through Asia. As I said, it's now in Timor-Leste, which is about 650 kilometres from Darwin. Simon Quilty is a meat and livestock analyst, and he's been following this story very closely.
The outbreak first began on September the 9th, and since then they've recorded 100 outbreaks and 405 deaths so far in two provinces. I think we've got to put it in perspective that the size of the pig population in East Timor is only 400,000 head, but I think what is so significant about this is firstly that it's only 650 kilometres to Darwin, and secondly, just how the disease moved so quickly from Vietnam and or the Philippines, which are respectively 1,500 and 2,000 kilometres away. That's their nearest contaminated country. So it begs the question, how did it get to East Timor?
Human transfer, is that the theory?
I believe so, and that's always been the concern of the Australian Department of Agriculture, their biosecurity division. And this was raised 4 weeks ago at the meeting we had with the Minister for Agriculture, Senator McKenzie. And she, you know, at that meeting, there was a lot of detail about where the country we're most exposed. And that is definitely through the airports and through the mail system as well. But they highlighted that through the airports, they deemed about, you know, the 20 million travellers we have each year, there was something like 6.3 million that they should screen. And of that 6.3 million, it's about 4% they regarded as high risk in terms of biosecurity. That is a lot of people. That's 250,000 people going through our airports every year that they deem as high risk.
And on top of that, have I read reports correctly that resources such as sniffer dogs have been on the decline?
They have, and that was raised at the meeting in which back in 2012 there was something like 80 sniffer dogs, and today there is 36 across the country. The reason given was that they were better utilising those dogs today than they were 7 years ago, that they have multiple roles across both seaports, postal centres and airports. But there's no no doubt that it does beg the question, do we need more? And I think in terms of resources, full stop, what was clear from every state chief veterinary officer and federal veterinary officer is that they are so stretched with so many other biosecurity issues that they are genuinely concerned about their own resources to try and tackle a disease as significant as African swine fever.
A disease that is now well and truly on Australia's doorstep. Do you feel the Australian government and industry is doing anything particularly different right now to keep this out?
First of all, full credit to the Minister, Mackenzie, for organising that meeting back on September the 6th. What it did highlight was the need for communication and the role to be very well defined of each organisation, both government and private, and what they are to do. That was a clear message of the day. As stated, there is concern about resources. Are they doing anything different today than back a month ago? Probably not, but I would say that this East Timor situation or issue that's now occurred will bring to the fore the need to act upon, I guess, a lot of the findings of that day itself, and the need for urgency to ensure that we are, I guess, putting all the various systems in place to try and keep the disease out of this country.
In Darwin, where I am today, there are regular flights between here and Dili. How big a concern is that for Australia?
I think it's always a concern, but let's keep in mind that it is a relatively small pig population that resides in East Timor. So, first of all, there is that need to ensure that screening is kept at an absolute maximum. Secondly, one of the real concerns is contaminated food products coming in. And that's something that we've noticed or has been a real factor in China is that it's in the food system. And so when you have swill, which is effectively the waste product that goes to these backyard pigs, that then keeps spreading through the entire community as it becomes more inherent in the food chain. So point being is that it's not just ensuring that the clothes, the shoes and everything else is checked, but also that they're not bringing in contaminated food products that could easily bring in the virus itself. You know, in terms of the real concern is, and these are the lessons that we're learning, Matt, from Europe and from Asia, but from Europe is the control of wild boars is critical. And I think in terms of Australia, we have 24 million head of wild boars or wild feral pigs.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that is our number one concern, if it should ever get into Australia, is managing that feral pig population.
On social media, I saw one farmer saying that this would be one way of getting rid of Australia's feral pig population. Now, what's your thoughts on that perceived upside?
Well, the issue there is that the virus doesn't necessarily kill feral pigs. And that's been proven throughout Europe and Africa, is that they're vectors or carriers of it, but they actually don't kill them. So it's all well and good to believe or hope, but in reality, we've found in the past that that simply isn't the case. These animals are the carriers. They're not necessarily going to die from the disease itself.
You've written that at the current rate of infection, if it keeps going like this, that potentially by the middle of next year, 365 million head of pigs gone, dead because of this disease. That's hard for people to wrap their heads around, I'd imagine.
It's very hard. And what we've seen in China and Vietnam and other parts of Asia is that the rate of loss, and that's either through farmers bringing the animals early to slaughter in fear of getting the disease, or secondly, from disease actually getting the pigs, or thirdly, that they're culled because they're potentially in harm's way and could be a carrier. But all up, the rate of loss in the last 2-3 months within China has accelerated. And 2 weeks ago, we saw around about a 38 to 39% loss of hog inventory over 12 months. And that last month or two means that probably by the end of this year, it will be close to a 70% loss. And there's no reason we can't assume, given all the cultural practices of China, that the same won't occur through all these other Asian countries. So, as stated, that's close to a 48% loss of the global pig population should the same be repeated elsewhere through Asia that's occurred in China.
48%, that's one in every two pigs dead.
That's correct. And that would lead, Matt, to an enormous global shortage of protein. And we estimate that to be close to 20% global protein. That includes not just pork, beef, sheep meat, chicken, the lot, that we are talking that would be lost by the middle of next year should China's situation be repeated elsewhere. So that is, dare I say, bullish for protein, but in particular for beef and for sheep meat and for chicken prices.
Simon Quilty, he's a meat and livestock analyst talking with Matt Brann about the spread of African swine fever. This is the pig-killing disease. It's just on Australia's doorstep, being confirmed now as it spreads through Asia, now in Timor-Leste, about 650 kilometres from Darwin. And the Department of Agriculture says it's monitoring the risk associated with African swine fever across the region, and in particular the risks associated with travellers arriving into Australia from those ASF-affected countries. There are 9 weekly direct flights from Darwin to Dili. All arriving travellers on those flights are risk assessed, and high-risk travellers of interest are identified for biosecurity screening. The department says it is writing directly to airlines arriving from ASF countries, so the airline crew are briefed to support passengers in understanding the biosecurity requirements and completing accurate declarations before entering Australia. And the department says it's providing information in country to Timor-Leste to high-risk cohorts, people like, you know, seasonal farm workers travelling to the Northern Territory, and is looking at further options for offshore messaging. Also today, I did put a call into the local, well, State Minister for Agriculture's office just to see if there's anything in particular that's being done to protect Western Australia, anything extra at the ports, etc. Obviously a public holiday here, so we might get the minister or someone from the department over the next few days or so. And did also put in a request to the Federal Agriculture Minister, Bridget McKenzie, just to see what is going on at that level of government. Possible that she'll be on the Country Hour tomorrow. That request in right now. This is the Country Hour, and it's 18 past 12.
The WA Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Radio WA.
Well, as we get closer to summer, the eastern states is still in serious drought. The Federal Water Minister, David Littleproud, says it's time the states started working with the federal government to get more dams built to better drought-proof the country. Shortly, you're going to hear from him and also the Shadow Agriculture Minister, Joel Fitzgibbon, because he is highly critical of the way the government is handling drought assistance. But first, let's head to Pooncarie in the southwest of New South Wales. 6 fruit farming families in this area on the Lower Darling River have spent 5 years trying to hand back their high security water licences in exchange for compensation to get out of the industry. But they haven't managed to get the deal done. And now, with a dry river and virtually no irrigation water left, they say they have no choice but to get out. So, as Saskia Mabin reports, this will be the final harvest of citrus fruit grown in the valley.
Alan White's family has been growing citrus on the Lower Darling since the 1930s. After almost 90 years of farming, this year's crop will be the last. Alan is turning off the pumps and abandoning his trees because the river has dried up.
that's the end of the business. It's as simple as that. You can't pick up the tree and park it. You can't mothball it and then think you'll fire it up in 2 years' time. It's the end of the business. And that's what we're facing here now. This current season has been quite good. We've had a good crop of fruit. It's been a valuable crop. And in terms of the current season performance, it's a good average result. But there won't be another crop from here, ever.
According to Mr. White, the river has dried up largely because of how it has been managed.
A lot of the issues can go back in time. You can go back 30 or 40 years and look at things that perhaps should have been done differently. But it's an ongoing process now, and in terms of what the threats are now, it's very much driven by the Basin Plan.
For 5 years, six growers, including Alan White, have been negotiating with the government for a deal to protect their livelihoods. They want compensation for the loss of their businesses and a buyback of their water allocations. But long delays have pushed them to the brink.
For those families on the six properties, it's been a pretty tough ride for the last 5 years. The balance sheets on those properties have been destroyed. The income stream can still be okay. In the case of citrus here, we've had a sound crop. But there won't be another crop. And you can't really sell or list for sale or value any of those properties at anything other than dryland properties at the moment. And that's a very big hit for those families, and that should be covered off.
Even if there were flows down the river, their businesses would still be jeopardised by a plan to alter the management of the Menindee Lakes, which feed the Lower Darling. Rachel Strawn is one of the six citrus growers affected. She said they were told by the New South Wales government in 2014 to ask the federal government for a compensation package.
New South Wales government came to us in 2014 and said that under the Menindee Lake Savings Project there was no future for horticulture on the Lower Darling and that we should seek a compensation package from the government. That was handed over to the Commonwealth in 2016 and we've been going through their process and due diligence for the last 3 years, which feels a long, slow process for us because it's hampered all of our business decisions moving forward because they've basically said we have no future, but we don't have any income if we don't grow permanent planting. So we're desperate for them to make up their mind and actually come through with that compensation package or else somehow manage to get water down the river and we remain here.
It's a drawn-out process that has reached crisis point.
I don't know how we're going to put food on the table. I really, really don't because all of our income stream and that is through horticulture. So all of our capital is tied up in the farm, in our permanent planting setup, whether through all the infrastructure that we have. And, yeah, it's an impossible situation that we can't even imagine if this doesn't go through.
It's not only the citrus growers that are feeling the stress. This is the first year that Nerida Healy won't be able to grow table grapes at Courtenarine Station. And she says her children have picked up on the seriousness of the situation.
It's a bit sad when your kids actually play meetings as their game and they set up at the computer. Or as my two-year-old said to me one day, shh, I just need to do these emails and I just need some quiet. So they're unfortunately used to us, needing to do this stuff, needing to attend meetings. And they do question, why do you keep, why you always got these meetings? And I try and tell them, because we're trying to look out for their future too. We want to see a river that they can play at and, that all the wildlife can water at and things like that.
In a statement, the Department of Agriculture said final negotiations on the terms of an agreement with the citrus growers will begin next month. It says it is considering expert advice to ensure that any agreement represents value for money. In the meantime, Rachel Strawn is not just worried about her business. She is also concerned for the future of the Darling River and wants to see it protected for generations to come.
The Darling's a beautiful river. It gets in your blood. And if we're expected to give up our horticulture businesses and our and the most amazing cash flow that we've got really successful businesses, it can't be at the detriment to the local environment. Like, it's a womb of the basin, the Lower Darling and the Menindee Lakes, and it's critical that we as Australians all actually make sure that government has policy that protects that. I'm not prepared to give up all our horticulture and then also lose the local environment. That's just, you don't do that. That'd be criminal.
Citrus grower Rachel Strawn from Tolney Point Station on the Lower Darling, ending that report from Saskia Mabin. 25 past 12 here on the Country Hour. And this week, Federal Water Resources Minister David Littleproud is touring drought-affected parts of northern New South Wales and southern Queensland. And the tour comes after Prime Minister Scott Morrison just promised an extra $100 million for drought-affected communities. David Littleproud and the Treasurer have flagged that new dams are on the agenda as part of the federal government's response. But David Littleproud is also calling for an audit into rainfall figures provided by the Bureau of Meteorology. The government uses those figures to figure out which areas should get drought assistance money. And the reason for the call is that last week a council in southwest Victoria said it did not actually need any drought money, despite being allocated $1 million in the last round of funding announced just last week. Shadow Agriculture Minister Joel Fitzgibbon says he's flabbergasted at the way the federal government is handling drought assistance at the moment.
Look, this is a terrible outcome. You know, we were all hopeful that when Scott Morrison made his latest announcement on Friday regarding the drought, that finally something meaningful would be done. But this again was modest, piecemeal and ad hoc. And, you know, obviously we can't believe it when they're declaring somewhere like Moyneshire in drought when the mayor down there is saying, hey, we don't need this money, please give it to someone else. And yet, you know, townships like Singleton in my own electorate or a number of townships in the electorate of Edmund Eyre are missing out when they are clearly impacted by drought. So something's going terribly wrong here.
Well, no additional money for areas like Pooncarie or Walgett or Wilcannia. There was no additional help for Merriwar and Murrurundi, places like that, where they're on level 6 water restrictions, you know, less than 3 minutes of showers and things like that. No extra help for those communities that have been in drought for a long, long time.
And this is why we need the release of the Drought Coordinator's Report. I mean, Major General Stephen Day was recruited to do really important work to develop a battle plan, to analyse current programs to see how effective they were, to recommend how we might do things better. And we welcome that because the government had abolished the COAG reform process, so I thought we might have been just getting back on track with him. But I think it was just the uniform they wanted, not anything meaningful. They're refusing to release that report from Major
and
General.
And he says he's handed it in. He's quite happy for it to be released as
No doubt. And I suspect the government refuses to release it because he's done his job properly and he's been critical of the inadequate nature of current programs and the lack of strategic direction in drought policy in this country. The other thing that has to happen is that Scott Morrison needs to be honest with the Australian community. He continues to run around saying they are spending $7 billion on drought programs. Now, this is patently untrue. I don't know who he thinks he's kidding. Farmers and rural communities know it's untrue. They're not receiving any of these monies. I think his target audience are those in the cities and in the suburbs who expect a Prime Minister, a government, to do something for these drought-affected communities.
Now, we're also hearing, in fact, the Federal Water Minister, David Littleproud, was saying we're actually blaming the Bureau of Meteorology. He was talking about using those figures to determine the areas that were in drought and might have needed assistance. Let's hear a little bit of what he said on RN earlier today.
With due respect, there's a methodology that's put in place that's predicated off the Bureau of Meteorology. They drought map each shire. And as at the 30th of June, according to the Bureau of Meteorology, 62% of that shire was in drought. That triggered, along with 12 other shires who were also in drought, our response, which the Prime Minister announced on Friday, to provide them with a stimulus, a $1 million stimulus to help build those communities.
So that's the Federal Water Minister, David Littleproud, laying the blame with the Bureau. Your thoughts on that, Mr Fitzgibbon?
It's always someone else's fault, isn't it, Michael? I mean, they said they were taking responsibility for building dams, and they talked about it incessantly for 6 years and didn't turn a sod of soil, let alone build a dam, and now it's all the state government's fault. It's the responsibility of the states, they now say. But instead of blaming the Bureau, let's just have a bit of common sense. David Littleproud should just come to my electorate and drive from Gerry's Plains to Denman, two small towns very close together, and tell me why one should be included in the drought declarations and one should not. Now, you'd only also have to go to the DPI website in New South Wales to confirm that Singleton is drought affected, or talk to the mayor of Singleton, who will tell you that consumption is down in their town because of the impact of the drought on her farmers. But one last point. They won't give us this model. They won't give us this model, they say, this robust model they say they rely upon. But can I now conclude that Singleton will be included if he's going to revisit having this so-called forensic audit? I hope springs eternal for me.
Now, another question, a question without notice. So the African swine fever outbreak in Timor, how concerning is this? While I've got you on the line here, how concerning is this for Australia to have this disease so close?
Well, it's a very, very serious concern. And, you know, I'm even more troubled by the fact that the CREIC review into our biosecurity framework said we need more money. And given the constraints on government, we need to go to industry for money. And they proposed a levy on industry to pay for additional biosecurity measures. We supported that. We said, yeah, that's good. Let's do this. Now, the levy was supposed to be in by July 1. The government buggered it up, and then they said September 1. They buggered it up, and it still isn't in. And in that period, we've lost $20 million worth of additional biosecurity money. And, you know, that's undermining our system, and they need to get this levy sorted out. We still stand ready to back it on a bipartisan basis. We need to get it done quickly. Otherwise, our biosecurity guard is going to continue to decline.
Shadow Agriculture Minister Joel Fitzgibbon with Michael Condon. And there's going to be more on that story on The World Today after the news at 1 o'clock. Let's get an update from the newsroom right now, though. 28-1 and Vicky Saleur in the studio.
Thanks, Belle. From tomorrow, patients may save more than $100,000 after drugs for diseases such as lung cancer and acute leukaemia are to be added to the PBS. Health Minister Greg Hunt says it's estimated around 500,000 people will access the lower cost medication. Prime Minister Scott Morrison has accused the opposition of taking an immature approach to Australia's relationship with China. Deputy Labor leader Richard Marles has recently returned from a visit to China and says the relationship between the two nations is terrible and has deteriorated under the coalition. In the AFL, Justin Longmuir says Fremantle's playing list has some real strength and the fundamentals for success are in place. The Dockers have confirmed Longmuir has been appointed head coach for at least the next 3 years after Ross Lyon was sacked last month. And the AFL Commission has approved an assistant package to the Gold Coast Suns after ongoing issues at the club. The package would allow the team to get first pick in the 2019 draft, as well as first pick of the second round. And I'll have more news at 1.
Vicky, thank you so much for the update. It is 27-1.
The WA Country Hour with Belinda Barischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Still to come between now and the news at 1 o'clock. No markets today, being a long weekend, our public holidays. So tomorrow we'll do the double header, the Mouchet sheep and cattle. I think it's Tracy Kilner's on deck for the next few weeks anyway. So we'll have that tomorrow. Also, having a look at whether Northern Australia could become that spice producing bowl of Australia. And we'll head off to the Weather Bureau right now because Stephen McInerney is waiting for you. Stephen, let's have a look at northern and eastern parts. What can you see?
A lot of clear sky, actually. So we did have some thunderstorms that's moved off eastwards into South Australia. So there are a little bit of thunderstorm activity sort of lingering around the interior district this morning, also in towards the Eucla. But yeah, as I said, it's cleared off to the east. So generally, we are expecting some pretty fine conditions through there over the next couple of days. There might be the odd shower or so up in the northern parts of the Kimberley over the next few days, but really nothing too significant. So I guess the main feature out there, certainly today and tomorrow, is the fairly gusty northeasterly winds through the inland parts of the Kimberley, also the north interior, leading to some severe fire dangers. And then I guess on Wednesday, there will be some mid-level thunderstorms developing through the Goldfields, also the adjacent Eucla, and potentially also in the South Interior District. So that will continue on Wednesday, a little less likely on Thursday. So I guess we are seeing, you know, some thunderstorms sort of at least developing out through there, but really not much in the way of rainfall expected. On Friday, there is a chance that we will see a cold front that sort of moves through the south of the state. So we might see a little bit of shower activity for the southern goldfields into the Eucla district during the afternoon and evening. But it is a long way away at this stage, and a little bit of, I suppose, a model uncertainty at this range. So I guess just, you know, wait and see.
All right, we'll wait for the detail on that. But let's head into the Southwest Land Division and talk us up to that point anyway.
Yeah, so we do have a cold front approaching the southwest corner, so it's just basically reaching Cape Naturalist as we speak. So some showers for that western part of the southwest land division. That's going to slowly move eastwards as we go later on this afternoon and evening, so push up towards, I guess, the lower west and into the south coastal districts. Most of the heavier rainfall will be more towards the southwest capes, and there is a slight risk of a thunderstorm for those coastal parts, say, between Busselton and towards Walpole this afternoon. Ahead of that, there's a chance that we might see some thunderstorms as well for eastern parts of the southeast coastal district, the adjacent Great Southern into that southeast coastal as well. So just a little bit of thunderstorm activity through there, which sort of should clear off to the east as we go during tomorrow morning. So, yeah, really by, I suppose, sunrise tomorrow, any showers will be most likely along the south coast and very light. And then on Wednesday, some showers will just start developing again for the southwest cape, so most likely during the afternoon and evening. We aren't expecting too much in the way of rainfall on Wednesday itself, so maybe very light falls at that stage. But then another front, a stronger front, will actually start to develop through the southwest of the state. It's a bit of a complex system at this stage, so it won't really progress too far eastwards as we go over the next couple of days. So really just areas southwest of, say, Geraldton towards Esperance. Most of the rain at this point does look like it'll be more on Friday as well. So on Thursday, most of the falls will be on the southwest corner, so say 5 to 15 mils are possible, probably around areas southwest of, say, Busselton towards Walpole. And then Friday, a bit more rain is expected. So areas southwest of, say, Perth through to, I suppose, Bremer Bay, you could be looking at 5 to 15 mils and more along the south coast. So even up to, say, 25 to 30 mils is possible in that southern coastal parts. But as I said, it does look like it's going to be progressing too far inland. So further north and east of that, over the southwest land division, you aren't expecting much more than, say, 1 or 2 mils at this stage.
All right, and warnings this afternoon, Stephen?
Yeah, so warnings. We do have a strong wind warning for the Albany coast for this afternoon and evening. As I said, that fire weather warning. So for the interior part of the Kimberley and also the north interior, and that is going to continue for the next couple of days.
Thank you, Stephen. Appreciate that. 22 to 1 on the Country Hour. Looking back over the weekend, and the highest rainfall total was 3 millimetres at Eyre, which is right on the WA South Australian border in the Eucla district, and I can't remember the last time that Eyre topped the rainfall figures. Still to come, off to the Perth Royal Show, giving you a little taste of that if you haven't managed to get to the show at this point, and it's only early days. It only started on Saturday, so you've still got a few more days to get there if that is your plan. Before that, though, that'll be just before the news at 1 o'clock today. Did you hear about the 5-week trial of direct flights from Perth to Shanghai? Well, Western Australia's crayfishing industry is keen to tap into that. During that trial period, thousands of kilograms of Western rock lobster will get flown direct to one of the industry's largest markets in China. The trial will kick off in January next year to coincide with the lucrative Chinese New Year period. Matt Rutter is the head of the Geraldton Fishermen's Cooperative, and he says he's really excited about this opportunity.
So we have been in discussions with the state government and the various bodies for the last, I think it's been a good year or two now, and looking at ways that we can support a direct flight in Shanghai. So it's quite a historic agreement which involves, you know, not only government to government and the airline itself, but by bringing Geraldton Fishermen's Co-op in and by underpinning the economics of the flight by guaranteeing that we'll put lobsters on every single flight during the trial period, it's really quite unique. And I think it's one of the key factors that's helped get this deal across the line.
How many lobsters can you get on each plane?
Well, it depends on the configuration of the plane. So, and we haven't had final confirmation of that, although I think China Eastern's looking into that at the moment from what I understand. But it can be anywhere from sort of 7 to 15 tonne of cargo space that's available on the wide-bodied aircraft. So that, as a proportion over the period of time that we're talking about, that's a large proportion of what we do on a daily basis during Chinese New Year, but it's we certainly ship out a lot more than that during the Chinese New Year. So Chinese New Year, we need as much airspace as we can to get the lobsters into the hungry Chinese hand.
And this trial will cover that Chinese New Year period because it starts on January 15th. So the timing there is good as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it's perfect, both for cargo as well as passengers. So the Chinese tourists are looking to go on holidays over the New Year period, and they're also celebrating back home, which is when they tend to eat most of our lobsters.
So, Matt, why Shanghai? Why was that market something that you thought was important to pursue and get this direct access to?
So the two main markets that we're exporting to at the moment are Guangzhou and Shanghai. Guangzhou, we have a very good relationship with China Southern, and have received similarly very good support from them and are putting good volume direct from Perth to Guangzhou. But a lot of the product that goes into Shanghai, which is our second or third largest, sort of shared second, third largest market, has to be transshipped through places like Hong Kong and Singapore. And what that does is it just extends the transport time, which for our product is the most important thing, is getting the product onto the ground and into our customers' hands as quickly as possible. So direct flights for lobster is absolutely critical, and Shanghai has grown, through the free trade agreement, has actually grown to be the number one market, you know, up in that northern region.
So this essentially reduces some of the transport time. How much of a delay was there, was having to go through places like Hong Kong?
It can be as much as 5 and 6 hours. It varies depending on the flights and the routes that we take, and particularly through that time if we have to take less desirable flights. So it really varies, but every hour for us counts. Time element is critical.
And it's a 5-week trial. Is there scope for this to become more permanent?
Yes, well, that's the intention. So it's a 5-week trial, and that will help, you know, both sides understand what the opportunity is. And then hopefully from there, we can go on to scheduling permanent flights like we've got now with China Southern and also with the new Japanese airline ANA as well.
Matt Rutter, he is the CEO of the Geraldton Fishermen's Cooperative, speaking to Joe Prendergast. And still on the topic of live exports, Fremantle-based livestock exporter Wellard has recorded a net loss after tax of $48.4 million for the end of financial year 2019. Executive Chairman John Klepek says poor market conditions throughout 2019, combined with $20 million of vessel impairments and financing costs, reversed the profitable first 6 months of the year for the company. He says the result is frustrating and disappointing, and Wellard is continuing the process of revamping its operations and restructuring its balance sheet, which may include further asset sales. You remember we've already spoken about it here, that Wellard plans to sell the MV Ocean Swagman for $22 million US dollars in a sale and leaseback deal to the Heytesbury Cattle Company, which is also a major shareholder in the company. That sale of the MV Ocean Swagman is going to be decided at a shareholder meeting next month. 16 to 1.
On ABC Radio WA, you're with Belinda Barischetti for the WA Country Hour.
Good to have you along. Could Northern Australia become the spice-producing bowl of Australia? That's a question the Cooperative Research Centre for Northern Australia is trying to answer with a new $1.2 million trial of spice crops. This is across the Northern Territory, Queensland and Western Australia. Cumin, fennel, caraway and black sesame seeds, all going to be trialled just to see if they are viable crops for the north. Sally Lago is with the CRC for Northern Australia, and she explained what the trial is going to be looking at.
Yeah, so this is a project that was proposed to us looking at some high-value spices and seeing if there was some economic opportunities as well as agronomic opportunities for growers in northern Australia to look at spices like cumin, fennel, caraway, black sesame and nigella. These are the project team with one of their partners, AgriVentus, have been receiving numerous inquiries about these types of spices and the opportunity for Australia to provide them. They've had inquiries from South Korea as well as Turkey into these types of spices. So the team's actually done some preliminary work with some glasshouse trials out of Rockhampton, and they've found some varieties that are looking very promising for these different spices. And now they're looking at wanting to scale those up and have trials on some commercial farms. So there's actually six farmers involved in the project who will be trialling these spices on a commercial scale, as well as they'll also be trialled here in the Northern Territory at the Department of Primary Industry and Resources Research Farms in Darwin as well as Katherine.
And what are the sort of markets for these spices?
Yeah, so the team feels that there's obviously markets in Southeast Asia as well as the Middle East, but also the majority of Australia's spices are imported as well. So there's actually an opportunity for these spices to be provided domestically as well.
Yeah, are these spices grown anywhere else in Australia, cumin, fennel, caraway and sesame seeds?
Look, there's been a bit of interest in sesame in the past, and there may be some trials going on with those from memory. I'm just not sure if they're down in southern parts of Australia. But as far as I'm aware, this is the first time that these crops are being looked at being grown in northern Australia. But some of the agronomy work that they're looking at is they also want to look at the different varieties and see how they adapt to the environmental conditions, as well as what sort of planting and sowing times are going to be needed, and then subsequent sort of nutritional issues as well. So what kind of fertiliser rates and things like that should be looked at. So there's, going to this commercial scale, there's still a number of questions on how to optimise the yields for these plants, as well as also understanding what happens with weeds and pests and diseases as well. So there's going to be a lot of learning once they take it out into commercial farms.
And when might we see some trial crops in the ground here in the Northern Territory?
Look, that's looking like that'll be 2020, that the plantings will happen up here in the Territory, and we would hope that we'd be able to have some field days from that towards the end of 2020, that local farmers will be able to get out and actually have a look at how these crops are going in the ground and then follow them through as they're going through their different stages of development. I think the trial will be followed with quite a bit of curiosity from farmers in the region.
Ultimately, is there a chance that the Northern Territory could become the spice capital of Australia?
Oh, absolutely. It's going to get very spicy up here, Dad. No, look, there's thoughts that this could be, you know, quite a significant industry for Northern Australia, around $8.4 million in economic activity, even towards the end of this project. I think the advantage this project team has is they have got a commercial partner in the project who is looking at being able to connect growers to the commercial markets in Southeast Asia and the Middle East. So I think there is a very strong chance that we will see these crops finding a marketplace and you know, delivering the economic benefit that we want to see from the work. So it's an industry that the research team advises me is growing at 5.2% per annum for the demand in these types of spices. So I think there's a great opportunity there for Northern Australian farmers to get involved.
Sally Liego, NT Project Manager with the CRC for Northern Australia, catching up with Dan Fitzgerald. 11 minutes to one. If you're a grain grower, do you think that you get value for money that you have contributed to the Grains Research and Development Corporation, the GRDC? Australian grain growers have to pay a compulsory levy to the GRDC, and the money is then used on research and marketing initiatives. And you often hear farmers wondering if WA benefits from the GRDC projects. And in fact, going back quite a few months now, the State Agriculture Minister, Alana McTiernan, was putting the GRDC under the spotlight too, just wanting more of a breakdown of the members, where the money's coming from and where that money is being spent. But Darren Lee, who is the GRDC's Western Panel Chairman, he thinks WA does benefit from the work.
We're very lucky in the GRDC, the fact we have a Western panel, a Southern panel and a Northern panel. And we have growers, we have agronomists, we have researchers sitting on those panels, and we get oversight of all of these investments. And above that, we actually have a national panel, which I actually sit on, and we have a chair from the Western and the Southern and the Northern and the Executive GRDC, which actually oversights all of the projects, which is growers' funds, which is my funds as a grower, and all of the guys I've spoken to this week. So we get very good oversight on that budget, and it is a significant budget and makes GRDC quite unique, being one of the 15 RDCs, so we can actually see where it actually hits the ground. So as a grower, I'm very confident going forward that we manage that budget very well, and we don't invest in things that, you know, aren't probable. For me as a grower, it's got to be real, it's got to be relative, and it's got to hit the ground.
Do you think WA does get its fair share of grower levies?
Well, I think if you did an analysis of what the amount of levies that were collected in Western Australia over the last 10 years, from the information that I've seen, we have actually outspent the number of levies collected in Western Australia 6 of the last 10 years. And we also need to be mindful of that other regions collect levies. And from the information, as I said, I looked at the other day, I think the northern region is actually the highest levy collector, given that they have a winter and summer crop. I think of possibly, you know, six or seven of the last 10 years. So it's about getting a very good investment and getting the best people we can to manage that project. And as I say, we're a national organisation, so it doesn't faze me at all if some levies are spent in the east to get that best available information.
Lastly, the threat posed by Black Sea producers seems to be getting more and more attention. What, if anything, is GRDC doing about the threat? What can it do?
Well, as I said, we've released a 5-year research development extension plan, RDNE, which is made up of 30 key investment targets. And in that key investment targets analysis, there are things like frost, there are things like logistics, there are things like heat. So whilst GRDC as a whole is not involved in the logistics of grain, and but there's also opportunities there to look at market opportunities with our investment with AGIC, all of those things. So we're very mindful on the gross margin and the return from growing grain crops.
And that's the GRDC's Western Panel Chairman, Darren Lee. 7 minutes to 1 o'clock.
Join us for The World Today.
Hello, I'm Eleanor Hall. On the program today, how is it possible that despite having a well-paid drought envoy, the federal government has given drought aid to a region that says it doesn't need it? US Democrats seek access to President Donald Trump's phone calls to his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, and a warning to get ready for another housing bubble, especially with the Reserve Bank Board likely to cut interest rates yet again.
We are actually laying another trap. We are building another property bubble. We are building another lending bubble. We have the highest indebted households in the world. We have the highest home prices relative income pretty much anywhere. And yet, we haven't learned the lesson.
More than the headlines. The World Today.
And also on The World Today, you'll hear about a butcher and a wildlife carer in WA's Kimberley region, an unlikely team who run the Derby Wildlife Sanctuary, which is an oasis for injured and orphaned wildlife from all over the Western Kimberley. Check out the animals in the online story. You can get to it most quickly on the ABC Rural Facebook page. The photos are worth looking through. They are very cute. 6 to 1, 6 minutes away from the news at 1. And the judging has started in this year's WA Olive Oil Awards. And the organisers are thrilled that for the first time in the awards history, the winners are going to be featured at a local retailer. Over 87 entries have been received from across the state, and there are also some from interstate too. The winner of the Best Commercial WA Oil of Show and Best Commercial WA Infused Oil of Show will be on the shelves across 12 Farmer Jack supermarkets. Tanuja Sanders is the Vice President of the WA Olive Council, and she says getting your olive oil in front of the customer is one of the industry's greatest challenges.
The big thing is about marketing and getting your product to the consumer through the retail outlets. So that our producers struggle with, you know, across board. And so this year, West Australian Olive Council took an initiative to negotiate with the retail industry to see if we can feature our winning olive oils on their supermarket shelves. And we were very fortunate that we had that opportunity with Mr. Fred Fairthorn, who is the owner of the 12 Farmer Jack stores and who is a real advocate for local produce and local products and advocate of buy West, eat best.
Tanuja Sanders from the WA Olive Council. The award night is on Saturday, October the 12th in Northbridge. And this year, throwing the doors open to you if you want to go along and sample some of those oils at that event. Just search up Olives WA in your search engine to get some more details about that. 521, taking you to the Perth Royal Show now, because Winston the Steer is being auctioned today, raising money for mental health awareness. John Daly is at the show and he's trying to track down 11-year-old Sean Smith, who's from a cattle property just north of Albany. His family donated the Red Angus steer for this annual charity auction.
15. I got 15 the better. I got 16 now. That's the way I took it. 16 up. Watch you. 16 there. 17 down. Clears the air. $1,700 bit of an 18.
Today we had the steer auction, and the black dog steers made $11,000, which was a new record for the black dog.
Well done, mate. You also played a big role in getting the steer ready for auction. What goes into it? Is it hard work, hard yakka?
Yeah, it is. We have to break the animals in, get them ready to walk, wash them, and we're brushing them, blowing them, making sure they look their best.
What do you enjoy about it?
I like blowing them and washing them. Yeah, I let him in the auction while the auction was going on.
And now you've won a record, $11,000. Pretty exciting.
Yeah, it is really exciting.
A good cause too. And I've got Judy Milton here. Judy, you actually helped set up this particular charity auction. It's the Black Dog Steer Auction. Is that correct?
It's actually, we do this for the Black Dog Ride.
Yes.
With the main aim of raising awareness to mental health, city and country. And my husband's actually not here today, but he's the one that actually is the main driver of it. And we've been doing this for about 11 years now. And we've taken animals, steers, heifers. Yeah, we're up to Winston 11, the 11th steer that's been donated and auctioned off. And we couldn't do that without the support that we get statewide. To do this, you know, there is so many people involved. There's mining companies, there's farmers, agents, stock agents. They're all right behind with what we do. And we travel to schools, men's sheds, street corners,
yeah.
Raising awareness of mental health. That's our main aim. Yes, yes.
And a brilliant job you do. And 11th Winston, can I ask, why Winston?
Winston is after Winston Churchill. His name, and he used to say the black dog was in his room. And that's why he suffered greatly from mental health, from depression.
And you also have the heifers or the cows are named after his wife, Clementine.
That's correct. Yes, we do. And through the generous support of the Golding family in Dardanup, Little Meadows, they donated a heifer this year to be auctioned off at a special auction in Melbourne. That was yesterday, and that heifer made $26,000, which is absolutely incredible. But Peter's over there at the moment, and what has done really raised awareness in the showgrounds at Melbourne, which we've been doing here for about 10 years, but it has really opened up the eyes of people over there and of what can be done and what we do. And there has actually been more money donated after that as well. So it is $26,000 plus.
Remarkable work. And who donated the steer and the heifer this year?
The steer was donated by the Smith family, Kildara Red Angus, at Albany. and that's young Sean, who's only 11, who did the speaking a moment ago. He's a credit to himself and the family. They donated the animal. They started with us 11 years ago with the first steer that we did, and they were part of that group that when we did it 11 years ago, and they've come back on, and they've waited 3 years to do this. There is a lineup of animals waiting to be Winston's. Yes, and it's incredible the support that we get in the farming communities, the RAS agents, stock agents, feed companies, mining companies. We couldn't do what we do if we didn't have that support.
Judy Milton, she's from Dardanup, and also 11-year-old Sean Smith from Kildara Red Angus in Albany. And they said they donated the steer. The steer has raised $11,000 for the Black Dog Ride, raising awareness for mental health issues. Good to catch up with you this Monday. Time for the news, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.